This is the Flip Empire Show with Alex Pardo, episode 34.
And I talked to a good friend of mine. He was ready to buy a plane, like a jet. Mm-hmm. He's a high net worth individual. And he said, I'm not as motivated to buy this now because I just lost $2 million in the stock market today.
Welcome to the Flip Empire Show, bringing you the interviews, strategies, and insights for smart real estate investors. Prepare to dive into the minds of real estate's heavy hitters and gain the cutting-edge expertise you need to scale and grow your real estate empire. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
Hey, my friend, Alex Pardo here. Looking forward to bringing you another masterclass here at the Flip Empire Show. And I got my buddy Lee Carney on the line. And, you know, what's great about Lee, and before I bring him on, I just want to give you a very brief introduction so that we can get into the meat of today's episode. You know, Lee's somebody that started real estate in 2004. And what's extremely impressive is that he's bought and sold well over 6,000 properties in the last 11 years or so, 11, 12 years. So, I mean, that's not only is he somebody that has just become an expert and a thought leader in the industry when it comes to wholesaling properties, but you know, he's built up a rental portfolio of about 200 properties, I think, in the Tampa Bay area. And so, you know, Lee's somebody that has seen the ups of the market, the downs of the market. And that's actually one of the things that I wanted to cover on today's podcast, because in the past, we haven't really talked too much about market cycles. And What's Lee's process for looking at a market and really staying ahead of the curve so that, you know, you can position your business to benefit regardless of what the market is going to do in the next 6 to 8 months, 18 months. Now, obviously, nobody has a crystal ball, so nobody knows for sure exactly what's going to happen. But, you know, the great thing about real estate is that you can make money in any type of market. It's just about leveraging the right strategies and positioning your company and your business to take advantage of what the market's doing. So having said that, man, Lee, I want to get right into it, man. I appreciate you being on the podcast here.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Awesome, buddy. So, hey, man, before we get into, you know, market cycles is one of the things I know we're going to talk about. We're also going to talk about marketing. One of the things I didn't mention at the top of the show is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think right now, your business is acquiring what, between 40 and 80 properties a month?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, depending on the month, a short month for us or a month where we wouldn't be happy with this. If acquisitions drop below 40, that's considered a fail. And we definitely have the bandwidth. And we've done upwards of 80, 100 properties in a really good month on the acquisition side.
So you know what, man? I mean, let's start right there because I know for a lot of people listening in, that's a mind-blowing number. You know, and it's extremely impressive to get to a point where you're able to scale to do 40 to 80, close to 100 properties a month. So you've obviously given us kind of a 30,000 foot view of what your business is doing today. Why don't we kind of start with the end in mind? How did you position yourself and your business to a point where you're able to do that much volume?
Well, it starts with systems really. And then you got to have good people implementing your systems. I think if you don't have both of those elements, you're not going to have a business that you can scale up.
Okay.
So that's really, I think, what makes us different. We got a system for everything and I got great people implementing them.
So walk us through, what does a typical day, a typical week look like for you and also for your business? Like, so obviously I know right before we started our recording here, you mentioned that you have about what, 25 people on your team right now?
Yeah. Between my Tampa office and my Miami office, that would be correct. Yeah.
Okay. And that's another thing, by the way, is that you're somebody that you're operating in different markets. So it's not like you're just taking advantage of a hot market in one area. I mean, you've done this across the country. So what's a typical week look like in, you know, if I was to walk into your office, what are the operations? How does your system look?
Sure. Well, obviously I'm the owner and the CEO. So I sit behind six monitors and half of my day is spent on acquisitions. As far as the doing part, that's what I do. Everything else is just overseeing the operation, working with my chief operating officer and making sure that any kind of higher level problems that him and I discuss, mm-hmm. and really reviewing reports and seeing what's healthy in the company, what's not healthy. And then I spend, after I focus on acquisition, after I review what's going well, what's not going well, I then focus the rest of my day on fixing problems and meeting with people and trying to come up with solutions to fix the things that are not going well.
Got it. Yeah, which is exactly what a CEO should be. It's somebody who's, you know, he's got a vision for not only the short term, but for the long term. He's steering the ship, managing the team. So when you say acquisitions, what types of properties are you acquiring? And you already obviously mentioned you're in Tampa and you're also here in my market in Miami. What are the types of properties that you guys are acquiring?
We buy at zero to 500,000 typically, and we buy anything we can make money on.
Okay, so you guys do short sales. Obviously, you know, REOs is something that I know you became popular 4 years ago. Do you also work with private sellers? I mean, is there any type of deal that you guys are not tackling right now?
No, we get a deal anywhere. If the deal is in Florida and it makes sense, we don't care where the source is. It's just down to price. I developed my own internal buying calculator that allows me to evaluate a property in 30 to 60 seconds, mm-hmm. depending on whether it's a wholesale or a retail deal. It spits me out a number of what I can pay for it, and that's what I can pay for it.
Got it. So, I mean, do you mind, can you kind of reveal how do you go about it? If somebody that might be starting out, or even somebody that's doing, you know, a handful of deals a month and they're looking to scale and get to that point where they might be doing 10, 15, 20 deals a month, which is half of what you're doing on the low end, how can somebody start looking at properties and quickly shaving time off so that they can identify, you know what, this makes sense for a wholesale, this might make sense for a fix and flip, for a buy and hold? Like, sure. what's the best way you can kind of give us some direction to start analyzing properties in 30, 60 seconds?
Well, I can tell you this, a quick rule of thumb for a rehab in today's market is you got to buy it about 50% of what its retail value is. So if you're going to sell for 200, you need to buy it at 100. And that's a very kind of quick and dirty rule of thumb. And so just to kind of put some meat on that, If a wholesaler is trying to wholesale me a house for 150 and it's worth 200, I can pass right over that deal and put it in the no trash can because I don't need to waste any more time on it. Mm-hmm. And so quickly what we do, as far as coming up with a litmus test on what the retail price might be, we always look at Zillow. And Zillow, the joke in our office is Zillow's God. But the reality is this, if you've got a standardized kind of house or a condo or a townhouse, Zillow spits you out a pretty good number as far as just a quick, you know, someone sends me a house for 200 and Zillow has 120. Unless it's just a ridiculously weird square footage or a very unique house, I'm not going to waste a lot of time in that deal. Mm-hmm. Because so Zillow, I would say, primarily helps me weed out properties that are no. And so ultimately what I want to do on the acquisition side is put stuff in three buckets, which is absolutely yes, absolutely no, and I need to investigate a little bit further, which typically will go to my field services team where they'll go get me a physical report on the property. And based on the physical report, I can either, again, put it straight in the yes category, straight no category, or I may need to run further comps to really look into it if it's a unique property. So that's what typically what we do. So once it passes the first test, as far as, you know, when you're buying a property, ultimately you have to sell it. So we always start with the selling price. We work in all of our expenses below that, and that's what gives us our buy price. But we always start with the selling price, and then we end up with the buying price. We don't try to start with the buying price and then try to fit numbers into that because that doesn't make sense. Now, you're starting with the premise that you already want the property. When we'd rather start with the premise, what can we sell it for? You know, what's it going to cost to fix it, if anything? And what are our other expenses? How long are we going to hold it? And then we let the calculator tell us what we're going to pay for it. It really takes the emotion out of buying.
Yeah.
And as far as determining the sales price, I mean, the MLS is by far your best tool. I have not seen any kind of auto valuation tool that's of any use when you're really looking for accurate comps. Your multiple listing service, in my opinion, my humble opinion, is always going to give you the best results. We look at three categories. We look at active, pending, and sold. Mm-hmm. Active tells you what your competition is when you put your house in the market. Pending tells you what's currently dropping in today's market. And you can pretty much assume that anything that's pending, that's been on the market for a reasonable amount of time, has dropped somewhere between 90 cents and 100 cents on the dollar as far as what the pending price is. And then solds are what you're going to have to defend when you sell your property to a finance buyer's lender. And so we always want to make sure that even if the market looks like it's moving, you may have a couple of anomalies. Let's just say they sold at 400,000, mm-hmm. but all of your other solds are coming in at 300,000. We recognize unless you get a cash or hard money buyer at 400 grand, you're going to have real trouble selling that property when it comes to appraisal time. So that's always in the background of our mind to look at active, pending, and sold. On top of that, it also tells you how quickly the market's moving. If you see a bunch of actives, no pending, and no sold, a lot of times we see that. You were talking about Miami earlier. When we see condo communities with a bunch of active and they're all got the down arrow, like the prices are going down.
Yeah, right.
And there's no pending, there's no sold. When you investigate those a little further, it could be something simple as it's coming up for 40-year inspection. HOA fees have gone through the roof and the market is still tumbling in that particular community and they haven't figured out where the new drop price is. So, you know, those kind of, if you've got a community with it just falling through the floor, that's tough to value because when we start with a sales price, how low do you start with your sales price? I mean, especially if it's tumbling and you got to rehab it, you got to put it on 6 months, is it going to be down another 10%, 20% before this thing start dropping? So that would be an example, just kind of a sidebar of something that's probably not a good flip because your end price is not predictable. And if you want to make a systematic approach to creating revenue, you got to have a systematic approach for buying. And that will turn into systematic revenue. And it comes down to being able to nail down a true sales price when you're listing an asset.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense, man. Appreciate you sharing that. In terms of acquisitions, Lee, what percentage, let's say on average, you guys are doing 60 acquisitions a month, more or less.
Okay.
What percentage of those are private off-market deals where, you know, and we're going to talk a little bit about marketing. I'm not sure if you're
5 or 10%.
Okay, so 5-10% are off-market properties. So 90% of these are MLS properties, whether it's a short sale, an REO.
No, MLS would make up about 5 or 10%.
Oh, MLS makes up 5-10%. Okay, so 90% is off-market private sellers.
They're either an auction platform, a county foreclosure auction, or a off-market from the standpoint it's a bank or institution, but they're not selling it to the masses.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So is it all about, I know, you know, back in the day when you came out with that product, REO Rockstar, it was about, the premise of it was building relationships with agents. And I can speak firsthand to that being true, especially, you know, 2011, 12, 13, 14. My experience, Lee, I started noticing inventory get tighter around 2015 or so. And it was getting a little more challenging to get these REOs. What have you seen the biggest differences between, you know, wholesaling and flipping REOs 3, 4, 5 years ago versus where it's at today? And what are you doing to, you know, to put yourself in the best position to acquire a lot of those assets?
Sure. Well, you kind of asked a few different questions there. So the biggest change I've seen is that banks are requiring the agent to hold it on the market for 5 or 10 days. And that basically means the masses come in. So if you've got a situation like that, I typically try not to compete. I'll put in my offer, but I'm not going to waste a bunch of time on it. Mm-hmm. And the only time we ever pick those up, Alex, is on round two, when the first buyer that bid 50 grand over the list fails. The bank gets their head out of the clouds and say, well, who do you have on your list who will actually close? And a lot of times that I can jump in on round two or round three on those kind of properties and pick them up at a decent price. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a big change I've seen. Also, there was a few agents that used to control the market 8 years ago. Now I see a lot more spread out where there's a bunch of agents with fewer deals rather than a few agents with a lot of deals. So that was another big change I've seen. Also, 8 years ago, when I started, converted my business to wholesaling after the market crashed, there wasn't a lot of buyers. It's funny, prices were never lower than they were 8 years ago in the previous 20 years, but yet there was no buyers.
Yeah.
So it was like, shooting fish in a barrel, you know, stealing candy from a baby, whatever kind of phrase you want to use. It was easy. And so I had 100% wholesale market, 100% bought from the MLS, and everything was turned back through the MLS for a higher price. It was almost a ridiculous model. If I told people what I did, they would just laugh and say that couldn't be real. But that's what I did 8 years ago. So I've definitely seen a huge shift in competition, a huge shift in the REO agents and the requirements of listing the properties, and also the amount of REO agents with where you've got a bunch of agents with just a very few amount of deals. So a lot of things have changed over the last few years. And I guess as far as how to address that, if you're fishing in a pond that everyone else is fishing in, you got to go find another pond to fish in. So I'm not a person, Alex, that's going to try to fight the market. I try to look at the market. I try to figure out where the opportunity for me in the market is. And then I create an action plan around that. chasing that opportunity. And that I probably go through that cycle three or four times a year as I see slight changes in the market, and then I redirect the ship where I think that we're chasing a better opportunity in lieu of an opportunity that's not as enticing.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, and that's actually a perfect segue into, you know, at the top of the show, I mentioned we're really going to get into market cycles. You touched on it a little bit when you talked about, you know, taking a look at the multiple listing service, realizing and figuring out what are the actives, what are the pendings, what are the solds. Can you kind of walk us through? I mean, you mentioned three, four times a year, you'll analyze and take a look at the market and then shift your strategies. Sure. Can you talk about what's the process you go through when you're, you know, from your perspective, when you're looking at the market and figuring out, and if you can try to frame it in the way that somebody that might be listening in, if they can maybe try to plug and play that process so that they can try to stay ahead of the curve. Because so many people ask me, hey, Alex, what do you think the market's going to do in 6, 12, 18 months? And I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on that. But more importantly, how do you analyze it? Like, what's the lens that you look at the market through, and what's the process that you go?
Several lenses. I look at it all the way from the national market, in fact, the international market, down to a national level, down to a state level, down to then an individual market within each state. And that's how I look at it from a very high perspective. And then if you go even drill that even further, I look at my business and what the actual figures are for my business in my current trades, and which ones I'm winning, which ones I'm losing on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our the shifts that we make, Alex, are not market-based, but internal-based. Because the market, if by all the metrics I look at, the market's on fire and I've got a problem in my business, I know it's an internal problem. So those are really kind of easy to pinpoint. I think that the issue you've got is when the market's working against you, you can have the best business structure in the world. And if you're not working with capitalizing on the current market and you're trying to fight the market, mm-hmm. you're going to lose your shirt no matter how good your systems are.
Yeah, all right.
So what I look at specifically, the first thing I look at is the global economy and just what the sense is from people that have money. The reason I look at that, investor confidence is what drives any economy. So if investors are confident in the market, they will open their wallets and spend money. When an investor at a large net worth people open their wallets and put money into the market because they're confident in the market, that stimulates an economy and drills all the way down to housing and keeping everything healthy. When people with money are not confident or feel scared, what do? They close their wallet. They take money out of the market. They stop spending money and putting money into the market. Mm-hmm. And so that's what dries up an economy, which again will translate into falling housing prices, you know, whether it's on an international or national level. And you see that all the time. You know, you get some, you know, you look at, you know, Britain that exited the EU a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Everybody freaked out. What happened? Stock prices around the world collapsed on that news. And I talked to a good friend of mine. He was ready to buy a plane, like a jet. Mm-hmm. He's a high net worth individual. And he said, I'm not as motivated to buy this now because I just lost $2 million in the stock market today. So this is the reality. The reality is that, you know, investor confidence has a lot to do with everything in the economy, including housing. So I just want to get a general sense of what people are thinking and how confident people are. Then I look at the housing data nationally. A big driver for me as a flipper is at peak pricing. You'll start to hear that word. Where did the market last peak? When did it last peak? And where did it drop to? And what caused it to drop? Mm-hmm. The good news is in most markets that we operate in, we're still at about 70-75% of peak pricing. And so that tells me that there's, you know, 20-25% of flex in the market as far as, you know, price has been able to go up. And typically the previous peak is lower than the next peak. So, you know, if you're going to be conservative, I definitely think a good conservative number is the previous peak, unless you've just got a very strange market that peaked for a very strange reason. And now the economy locally has collapsed and it'll never get back there again. But I'm talking about a normal economy and normal market. Typically the next peak exceeds the previous peak. So we definitely look at peak pricing. And we look at peak pricing not only at a state level, a national level, and a state level, but in our individual markets. And just to kind of give you a comparison, in Miami, for instance, peak pricing is running up quicker. It's running closer to peak pricing in Miami than it is in Tampa.
Yeah.
And so you've definitely got more flex in the market, I think, in Tampa over the next couple of years than you do in Miami. Miami, especially in the higher-end condo market, is essentially reached peak pricing. And you know, that's why we don't focus on high-end condos in Miami anymore. So this is what I mean. You're adapting your strategy and recognizing you don't want to be the guy left without a chair when music stops.
Yeah,
you also don't want to be chasing falling prices, especially competing with other scared sellers and driving your own comps into the ground. So that's a place that, you know, really no one wants to be. We also look at a tool called RBI Metrics, which is put out by our multiple listing service. What RBI Metrics does is it measures the measures several temperatures in the market, the number of new listings, the number of ones that went pending, what price they went, or the ones that sold, what percentage of list price did they sell at, how quickly did they sell it, what's the average days on market in Tampa, what's the average days on market in Miami, what's the average days on market in Hillsborough County. So that tells me, and then it's almost like a speedometer dashboard, Alex, so it's cool. So I look at, if it's all greens, I'm feeling good. If I'm seeing a couple of reds, I'm really investigating. Okay, looks like product's slowing down. I can see that less pending sales this month, and over the last 3 months, it's continually declining, yet available inventory is climbing. That's a big flag, right? So if days on market's going up, available inventory is rising, and pending sales are going down, that tells me that prices are coming back down, if I ever see that on my dashboard. So that's another tool we look at, and that's really kind of what we look at. And we do that on a monthly basis. We look at all of what I just mentioned.
That's so critical, man. I think you just highlighted and recapped the difference. You know, that I think that's probably, you would agree that that's a big reason where you guys are able to operate at a level where you're acquiring 40 to 80 properties versus somebody that is struggling to do 2, 3, 4 deals a month or even get started, is that you're looking at these key indicators and these metrics, and you're shifting your strategies and your business to take advantage of what the market is currently doing and what it's going to do based on what you're seeing. You said that resource, man, is RBI, like...
Yeah, RBI Metrics. I think I pay about $150 a year, and it's probably one of the most valuable tools in my tool belt. Because in 2 minutes, I can either feel bullish or bearish about the market by just looking at that.
That's awesome. Any other tools or resources like that you use to analyze the market, or really anything in general that you have found, you know, is kind of indispensable in your business?
Yeah, any of the websites that, like Zillow, Trulia, any of those kind of sites that show peak pricing, that's a great thing to watch, because you can drill down from a city level to a county level to a state level or even a national level and really understand. Because peak pricing, ultimately, you know, analysts are looking at these things. You got large hedge funds buying property. Everybody's looking at peak pricing because they want to understand how much potential equity is left in their property even after they purchase it.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, to give an example, you know, like right now, I think the market, we're probably approaching base camp, the first base camp. If we were climbing Everest and the top of Everest was the peak of the market, I would say we're nearing the first base camp right now. Okay. So we can see the peak, but we're not there yet. And that would be my personal opinion, you know, based on flipping a few thousand homes over the last 11 years.
Yeah.
And I think I'm pretty much on point with that.
Got it. So roughly, I mean, let's take the Florida market, and I realize this information might not help somebody who's in California, but let's just say if you're in a hot market, ballpark, obviously you don't have a crystal ball. Are you thinking that we're going to, at what point do you think, based on your experience and some of the metrics you're looking at, we're getting to that peak where really prices are going to start to decline from there?
Well, there's a big difference, Alex, between this particular approach to peak pricing versus the last one. The last one was purely driven by unhealthy lending. And this one's not. This is actually the current drive in prices right now is being driven by a lack of supply, because you got so many buyers that bought in, you know, for a long-term hold that are not selling. So me, and you got the banks whose foreclosures are drying up, who are really the only distressed sellers in the market. So there's a feeding frenzy in big part in a lot of markets down to a lack of inventory. And so the great news is, though, a finance buyer buying a 500 grand house, we're typically seeing these people put down 100 grand. That's way different than 8 years ago, or 9 years ago, 10 years ago, I will say, when you could buy a property with no money down, no income, no assets, you know, the old ninja loan they call them.
Yeah, which doesn't exist anymore, and I don't think we're going to see that again.
Right. So the landscape has definitely changed, but now you've also got some game changers, which you've got to put through your filter, like the political. There's a big political change happening here in November. Mm-hmm. So that's going to feed into market confidence, which, again, in my opinion, market confidence is what drives so much of what we're talking about.
Yeah, no, that's awesome, man. I mean, do you have a rule of thumb where you look at where you say, you know what, between X and X years, so let's say maybe between 7 and 10 years is typically when we see the peak to the valley of a market?
I think that after the last crash, Alex, my opinion is that that metric went out the window. Okay. It was such an enormous crash caused for non-conventional real estate reasons. It was basically a financial collapse in general that caused all of this. And it was such a large collapse because of the overlending in the real estate space. Real estate got hit really, really hard with that.
Yeah,
really. And that really, you know, in turn, end up driving the market down a lot of cases too. And so I think it was a self-propelling fire, in my opinion, 8-9 years ago. With it was the perfect storm for everything to collapse.
Yeah.
I remember when the Dow Jones hit, you know, 6,600. I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
It's insane.
Like, what's going on? People's wealth was destroyed overnight.
Yep.
And so I remember that so clearly back in 08 when the market just melted. Mm-hmm. And we could not give away a house there. And so that's why it was just a wholesale buy, wholesale sell. I was in and out of the market in a hurry. And even between 2008, when the financial market collapsed, I watched prices in the Tampa Bay area, just to give you an example, still continued to decline all the way through 2011.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I remember that, man. It was a crazy market back then. I mean, it was just, like you said, it was in certain areas, in certain parts of the country, it was tough to give away a property. So, you know, you look back at some of those prices and you just kind of shake your head.
Yeah, I remember I had friends buying 100 houses in Detroit for $500 a house.
Oh, man, that's so crazy to me. I can't even fathom that.
A couple $100 a house. I mean, I couldn't make this stuff up. We're talking like a brick home, solid home for $200, $300.
That's so crazy to me.
And a lot of these guys were buying them for $500, selling for $1,000. You know, making $500 a home, making $50,000 on 100 homes. I mean, just out of this world, like just crazy stuff that you could never imagine. In fact, I remember in 2008, I bought a first position note. It was a $120,000 note for 2.5 cents in the dollar.
2.5 cents?
Yeah, I paid like $2,800 or $3,000 for a $120,000 note.
Wow.
I was able to track down the borrower, get a deed in lieu, and flip that asset for like $30,000 within a couple weeks. It was just insane.
Yeah.
People could not run away from real estate fast enough. But my point to all that is that I envision the next peak that typically what follows a peak is a frothy period where the market's still trying to figure out where the new corrective point needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I envision that correction being more like a 10 or 20% correction rather than the most extreme example. I had a condo appraised at 140 and I end up short selling it at $25,000. And so, you know, that's just ridiculous, those kind of drops. But I definitely think, you know, based on all of the historical real estate data, after the frothy period and after the period of oversupply, eventually sellers do have to sell and you've got to lower prices to figure out where that new price point is, where it's enticing for both investors and homeowners to jump back in and buy property. So it's, I don't see it being as crazy as it was before.
Yeah, I got you.
Let's take the example of the $500,000 home. You put $100,000 down, you owe $400,000. If your house goes to 450, are you paying your mortgage still?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
If it drops to 400, are you still paying your mortgage?
Yeah.
Yes. Even if it drops to 350, you put $100,000 out.
Right.
Are you going to still pay your mortgage? I would say yes.
Yeah. Not too many people are going to walk away from that.
You bought a $500,000 house with zero down. It goes to 450. You're still paying your mortgage. Probably. Are you goes to 400? Are you paying your mortgage? Probably not.
Yeah, you're starting to think about it at that point.
No way.
Yeah.
300, absolutely not. Yeah. And so that's the difference. I really feel like there's a big difference this time around.
Yeah, today's buyer has a lot of skin in the game. And somebody who puts down, you know, 20, 25% on their property, very difficult for that person to walk away from it.
Yeah, I mean, I've got, you know, a rental portfolio with $8, $10 million worth of equity. And I'm not walking away from those properties. Even the values went down. They're all cash flowing.
Yep. Yeah.
So yeah, there's no incentive for someone like me to walk away because there's just too much equity on the table.
Right. So let's leave people with this, man. What is, I mean, because obviously we've covered a lot in the last half an hour or so. What's the one thing as it relates to everything we're talking about that you would leave with someone? And hopefully maybe it's something that can benefit, whether it's somebody that just wants to get started in real estate or even the guy or gal that's doing 3, 4, 5 houses a month and they're looking to really scale their business up. What's that one piece of advice you can leave us with that if they were to implement it, they could start to see results in their business?
Well, I think that really understanding your local market and understanding what the hottest product in your market is, both for retail buyers and for wholesale buyers. I would rather wholesale 10 hot houses at a slim margin than try to chase a house that's not as liquid and chase a bigger spread on a deal, because liquidity is what the name of the game is in real estate. It's about moving product quickly, whether it's wholesale or retail. And so having that local knowledge and really understanding, okay, this side of the tracks is hot, this side of the tracks is not. Mm-hmm. If I put a house on the market, there's no available inventory in this subdivision. And on top of that, everybody and their mom wants to move there. I'm going to focus on that subdivision for a slimmer margin because it's essentially a guaranteed sale.
Yeah.
Versus buying a house in BFE for 20 grand that Zillow's out at 100. And then you've got to go find a buyer that wants a house in BFE and wholesale for 30, yeah. 40. So it's just a much safer play when you know where the demand is in your local market. And you chase product in areas where there's huge demand.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to kind of piggyback on what you're saying before we get people out of here on this, it's you know, business 101, a mentor of mine told me years ago, it's figure out what people want and then provide a solution or fill a need to help them accomplish what it is they might be struggling with. So it's starting with the end in mind, and this is kind of the same approach. So Lee, man, this has been awesome, man. I've actually learned a lot in the last half an hour, man. So I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge and the experience you've built up over the last 11, 12 years. Where can people connect with you, man, if they want to find out more about what you have going on in your business?
Sure. I'm going to provide my email address. It's the best way to get a hold of me. I get several hundred emails a day. Check every one of them, respond to everybody. So my email address is lee.carney, K-E-A-R-N-E-Y, at spin, S-P-I-N, companies.com. That's with an S. So again, that's lee.carney at spincompanies.com. That's my direct email. If you'd be happy to get you on our buyers list if you're looking to buy a property. I'm a licensed broker, currently hired agent. So if you're a licensed agent, you want to hang your license with me, it's a great place to do it. I only charge $100 a month, collect all of my other fees from the other agents and the buyers. And again, those fees are minimal too, but it's really a good place. If you want to run a business under my broker's license, it's a good place for people like that, because we're the most cost-effective technology-driven brokerage that I know of in the state. So that's cool too. But yeah, I'd be happy to do business with anybody who's looking to buy or sell or hang their license.
That's awesome, man. Well, listen, I really want to thank you for being so giving, man. You and I have known each other for a handful of years now, and you've always been extremely giving of your time and just sharing, what's working for you. So really appreciate you jumping on the podcast here. And yeah, man, I know we've talked about it, but you and I, we got to connect for lunch here soon.
Yes. I will be in Miami in a couple of days, actually. So.
All right. Awesome. Well, we'll touch base offline, but listen, man, thank you. And, guys, if you have any comments, feel free to leave them here in the show notes. If you have any questions or comments and I'll do my best to get back to them as quickly as possible. And I catch you on the next Flip Empire show. Take care.
Sounds great. See you guys.
That's all for this episode of the Flip Empire show, but we have you covered with even more expertise and resources on our website. Text Empire to 67076 or head over to flipempire.com to join the newsletter and gain free instant access to our video module training course called 5 Ways to Scale Your Real Estate Wholesaling Business to 6 Figures in 6 Months or Less. For more interviews, strategies, and insights for the smart real estate investor, we'll catch you next time here on the Flip Empire Show.